an executive MBA at Georgetown isn't the path of least resistance, but it does come with the greatest reward. Benefit from our strong alumni network, renowned faculty, DC location, and global residencies. Get started at choosegeorgetown.com/EMBA.
Please listen carefully.
This is an Aquarian Radio special podcast. I'm your host, Karen Christine Patrick. On this program, I interview Dr. Ken Johnston Sr. at his home in New Mexico. Ken is an exemplar of one whose career was intertwined with the story of NASA. Ken Johnston worked for NASA on several major projects during the Apollo missions and after. He brings decades of experience reflecting on images of our manned moon missions and insider experience of the astronaut corps. When he was supervising the photos and artifacts coming back on the return trips of those missions, Ken noticed that the first generation prints from the negatives were being altered, as well as film of the moon's surface. He's exhibiting a need to tell this information and get it out to subsequent generations who may not have even been born during this critical time in human history. Ken has an extensive archive of NASA photos and other items that he is working on sharing with the world, as well as his personal story. Today, we are talking about his new book, Ken's Moon, Volume 1, My Human Experience. Speaking of his upbringing in Texas, his years in the military and as a pilot, and how he came to work for NASA, how he found out that NASA was covering up what it had found on the moon. I'm Karen Christine Patrick here today with Dr. Ken Johnston Sr.
Well, I get asked that a lot of times about what are the qualifications to become an astronaut. Way back in the early days, the astronauts usually were test pilots and military pilots. I learned to fly in the Marine Corps, and I got my first double degree as a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration and Accounting, then Career Aviation Management. Then I got my Aerospace Engineering degree, Bachelor's degree, and then the opportunity came around for me to get my first doctorate degree, and this was in Divinity, Doctor of Divinity, and then carry that on over and complete a doctorate in metaphysics.
You've been doing a lot of schooling.
One thing I've always learned and been told, that, you know, get an education, that's one thing they can't take away from you.
True.
If they do, then your brain's not going to be of any good to anybody anyway. So, now, the reason why I pushed real hard after being one of the first four civilian astronaut consultant pilots working for the Grumman Corporation, our job was to test the lunar module. Grumman built the lunar module that landed on the moon, of course. And our job was to test it in the vacuum chamber and be sure that all the systems were right and they worked for human compatibility, and then help train the regular astronauts how to fly it. So that's what was the opportunity to then become one of the regular astronauts. I have letters of recommendation from Neil Armstrong, Jack Swigert, Buzz Aldrin, Jim Irwin, and just about any of them I wanted, because we were all friends working on helping them land on the moon. And astronaut Vance Brandt, he called me in and says, Ken, have a seat. And I'm all excited because I know they're going to announce the next week of who the final 26 are that are going to become the new group of regular astronauts. I said, and he says, Ken, I don't know how to tell you this. He says, but the government's gotten involved in the selection process. And if any of you folks know what happens when the government gets involved in something, it gets all messed up. He said, the government doesn't want to have jet jocks anymore. They want to have PhD scientists, and you only have 3 bachelor's degrees, so your name has been cut from the list. He says, and I'm sorry. Well, that was quite a shock, because here I'd been doing the same work. I'd been to the same training as regular astronauts. So I said it was time to get my aerospace engineering degree, and I got that. And then I got my first doctorate degree, and I reapplied for the astronaut program to be part of Skylab and part of the early shuttle program, and got down to near the end, and then I'd get called in. As they said, you're too old.
Oh, wow.
So another shock. Well, and I got my second doctorate degree, and here 3 years ago, a company out of the Netherlands called Mars One that's planning on sending humans to Mars to colonize Mars. It's a one-way trip. I jokingly say it's one way, and my wife signed me up to go, but now she knew that going to Mars has been my dream all my whole life. The moon was a goal, but it wasn't my goal. It was part of being part of the team to get there and get the job done, but it was still always Mars. So they said they were looking for people between the ages of 18 and 80. Well, at the time when I applied for the Mars One astronaut program, I was only 70. And with ancestors who have lived over 100 years, I was told I was a shoe-in. They sent me to Switzerland and Poland and all of the United States promoting the Mars One program. And then when they started off with 202,586 applicants from around the world. Then they got it down to 11,000. Then they cut it on down to 1,058. Then they got it down to 760. And then that was down to 605. And then the final thing was to select 100 to go into training and to be able to select the final 24. Well, once they announced the 100, a friend of mine, Lieutenant DeRose, he and I sat down and we went through the list of those 100, and not a single one of them was 60 or over. They were all under, which means, again, age they were figuring. But I'm tempted to send a letter to him saying, I think you guys messed up, because if you're considering my age, by the time we launch and get there, I'm still going to have another 20 to 40 years on Mars based upon my family's genealogy. Anyway, meanwhile, I'm very, very active with the Civil Air Patrol and helping other cadets have their dreams, and hopefully we'll get them to Mars.
Oh, that'd be great. Well, thank you for that good introduction. I decided that this interaction today would be a need to tell, because often you hear in the military, secret military complex, a need to know. But what has been happening in this last year, and you're one of the leaders of that, not everyone's got your genes and is going to last as long. And we've lost a lot of people who had very interesting information. I really feel like 2016 is going to be a big year of the need to tell. And so I had some questions and wanted to get your feedback on that.
Okay.
Are you concerned for this planet right now?
Well, we know for a fact through archaeology and geology, that the Earth has gone through some cycles. It's not just global warming. It happens to be the natural cycle that the Earth is going through. If you say, I have concerns, yes, I have concerns, because all it would take would be a fair-sized asteroid to hit the Earth, and it could wipe out the existence of Homo sapiens or humans. We need to be back into, I'll say it that way, being a space-faring species, of spacefaring nations here on planet Earth. I've had the privilege of meeting a few people in my lifetime that have experienced, have come across and told me things that they've experienced and that they've seen, not only just in our space program, but in their private lives. And I've always told them, you need to get that recorded somewhere. For instance, like a very dear friend of mine that's passed away, his name is Bill Pollack. And if you go in the internet and you look up William Pollack, he did a very lengthy couple of hours of interviews where he came clean on everything from ET contacts and the security of the underground bases that he was involved in developing the security for. And it was not allowed to be released until after his death. And it is still out there, so that's good. And other places where I've had conversations, people come up and tell me this. I said, we all need to come forward. If you don't get it out there before you die, then it's going to be lost. And so much history and so much truth has been lost because people, for one reason or another, out of fear or out of having their character drugged through the mud. And I had my fair share of people going after me, attacking me, saying, oh, well, you couldn't do this. And fortunately, I guess I was a pack rat. I saved documents and proof and letters from government and everything else. So all you have to do is just go to the government file, because I posted the letters and things, and prove that the things that I've said over the past few years are absolutely true. So the rest of you out there, if you've experienced something, this is the year coming up of disclosure. We need to get the information out there, because I think, you asked me what I think, I think it's going to be the time where we will be, not that we're going to be contacted, because we've been contacted forever, made public the existence of extraterrestrials and what influence they've had on our lives here on this planet. So if you've had, if you have experience and information, get with somebody, get with this group and get the information out there.
Are you concerned for younger people and for their future in mind?
I think our younger people have, society has been dumbed down, something terrible. And part of it has to do with I'm the older generation now. If you live long enough, we'll all be the older generation. I'll get asked a question, and I say, well, you know, I think I have that information. And I'll think in terms of which book, what area to go and find it. And while I'm talking about that, one of the young people will have their devices in their hand. The next thing you know, a perfect example, I was giving a lecture to a bunch of young cadets, and I was talking about being at the Smithsonian Institute and giving a talk there and then going around. And I'm telling them about things that I saw at the Smithsonian. All of a sudden, I hear my voice coming from this little iPad this kid had, and it's saying the same things that I was just saying. So I said, why don't I just shut up and go listen to it and watch it on the video? So what I'm getting at is that the young people, they instantly think of going to their cell phones or their iPads and pulling up and getting the answer, but it's not in their head. It's not part of their culture, not part of their brain, because you can ask them, you know, the next day about it, and they'll have to look it up again. So I am concerned about the youth and from that standpoint. The other part is that the education with the government's pushing on. In the small little town that I live in, there are a couple of schools, which one of them is like, it's called SODA, the School of Dreams Academy. And last year, they had so many full boat scholarships. People used to think that this was where the difficult, troubled kids were going to be sent to that school. Instead, what you found out is these are where the smart kids were. Yes, they were bored with the kind of school that they're being thrown into and the kind of nonsense that they could just be bored to death while they're out there. My son used to joke and say, he said, I was thinking about crystal oscillators and things like that, and they were talking about the ABCs. So, yes, the youth today, I'm concerned about them getting the proper education and being fit and ready for being a part of the future spacefaring episode of our society, our species.
Okay, so I have a little bit more involved question. What three steps should we achieve as a species to make a better future?
What three steps? I have the doctorate degree in religion. I've studied just about every major and lesser religions around the world. And unfortunately, it has created more havoc. There have been more millions of people killed because of slight little differences in what their belief systems are. And you see it's going on right now. Many people tell you we're already in World War III and the conflict with radical Islam. It's when you raise your children from the time they're 3 years old, walking around carrying somebody's head that you've chopped off, we're going to have a species or a culture that is not ready for any type of advancement. We're going to be thrown back to the primitive stage. Now, I'd like for you to rephrase that question for me one more time. You said three steps about what?
How we as a species can make a better future.
All right. One is we need to have more of an open mind and be ready to get data and facts before jumping to conclusions. That's one of the key ones. Two, for a better future, we need to be more concerned with what we can do to help one another instead of how we can take advantage of one another. Third, we need to be better stewards of what we've been given. This blue marble in space called Earth, with the water that we have on this planet, with the resources that we have. Yet, just recently I read an article where petroleum is going to be obsolete. They're looking at ways now that they can convert algae into a fuel for engines, but we still need to go one step further and get into hyperdrive, magnetics, etc. So in order for us to make that kind of advancement, the biggest thing is having open-minded, being, I think, a good example. My wife says, when she's asked about, what do you think about the extraterrestrials in this planet? And her little theory, and it's, listen to it, it makes some sense, kind of like Great Britain did back in several hundred years ago. They had so many prisoners and things, they decided to put a penal colony in a little continent down called Australia. Well, my wife's theory is that Earth became the penal colony for E.T., and they put a whole bunch of their bad people on this planet, and they come back periodically to check and see if we've blown ourselves up yet. And so we need to be able to move beyond that type of mentality of, if I can't get what I want from you, I'll take it from you. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
But that's excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, what led you to come out with Richard Hoagland in 1996 at the National Press Club event?
Why did I?
Yeah.
As you have discovered, I'm a bit of a pack rat and a sci-fi buff, science fiction buff, and a science buff. And I had read, Richard Hoagland's book called The Monument of Mars. And this had to do with when Walter Cronkite was the narrator of the first landings we did on Mars with our robotic probes. And the one in orbit sent back this picture, and everyone laughed and said, "Well, look at that, it looks like a face." And it was the face on Mars. So I had read the book, and in fact, there was a little group of us at Boeing, the Boeing Aircraft Corporation, that we kind of called ourselves a little Majestic 12. Now, don't get us confused with the real Majestic 12. But that way, it gave us more eyeballs. If someone just see something or hear something or find an article or something, then we'd use the interoffice mail and send it to each one of us. And one of them contacted me and says, "Oh, Ken, this guy Richard Hoagland, the author of the book you just finished reading, is here in town giving a lecture." And great, I'm off tonight. I was a 737 flight instructor, and I was off it. So I went to the conference, and before I left the house, I decided I needed to have a letter of introduction, because I had read and listened to him on Art Bell, and he was saying there are people out there that have information, that have pictures and stuff, and they need to come forward with it before it's lost. So I wrote in there and told him what I had, and which people around the world now have understood. They're calling it Dr. Ken Johnston's archive. Well, I went to the conference with my book, or his book, I should say, and I met the people taking the money. I was ready to pay my entrance fee to the conference, and I said, "Oh, and here's a letter of introduction for Mr. Hoagland." She looked at the letter, read a little bit, and her eyes got big, and she says, "Don't move. Stay right where you're at." And I'm thinking, I'm in trouble. Maybe I shouldn't have told him that much. And just a couple of minutes later, Mr. Hoagland comes out from the back, speaks to me about who I am, what I had in my archive, and he says, "Come with me." He set me on the front row and says, "We'll talk after the conference." And a couple, several hours later, we were through, we talked about what I had kept when I was the director of the data and photo control department at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. And he asked, and I agreed, that he could come over with the team, four of them, to my house the next day, and I would get into the vault and I'd have my collection out. Well, he came over, and they were looking at some of the pictures and things, and one of the guys says, "Oh my God, this stuff is really real. We couldn't see that on the other picture." The reason being is, you order a picture from NASA today, and it's going to be a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. Have you ever used a copy machine and make a copy after of a different one, and pretty soon it's so blurry you can't see what's there? Well, my pictures and things were made off of the original negatives, because of the, I had to provide that kind of detail to the scientists and geologists that were studying the lunar samples. Well, while we're doing that, my wife says, "What is this reflection in the astronaut's visor?" And that's become one of the most famous ones. If you really want to know what the astronauts saw on the moon, don't look at the picture. Look at the visor of the one having his picture taken. You'll see what's behind the one that's taking the picture. So that was it. So Mr. Hoagland said, "You know, we're going to have a conference with the National Press Club next week. Would you be my guest and come there and come spoke?" He says, "Here's the reason why. we could name off the event, number of people who have started to come forward with information, or it's knowledge that they have various information, that they have met in auto accidents, they died of a fast cancer or what have you. And Mr. Hoagland was concerned that if he could make me public enough, that if anything were to happen to me, it would be so many questions asked that it wouldn't be fair. So in reality, and I'm not pointing fingers at any organization or what have you, why they would want to get rid of me. There are many reasons they would, but they're now having to be careful and take care of me because they don't want all the investigations that would take place. So I was invited to come to the National Press Club, and as a matter of fact, several years later, went back and we had another press conference. But and that
what year was that?
Well, 1996 was the first one.
Right.
And the other one was about... Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
You're absolutely right. I think you're right.
And you went back again. I was busy that you got them the next week.
After
that, when you met Richard.
But that second one was very interesting because I had been tapped and had became one of NASA, NASA / JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, one of their solar system ambassadors. And that's the term they can't coined. And there were solar system ambassadors just about in every state. And that our job was to go out and give lectures to schools and organizations and tell them what a wonderful job we're doing going into space and what's going on. And I did that for almost 5 years. Not once did I ever tell them anything about what I knew we had seen on the backside of the moon. I was just doing my job. I got a call from the director of the Solar System Ambassador Organization within JPL, and I won't mention the name, but she said that Mr. Hoagland's book came out as new book.
Dark Mission.
Yeah. And she says, and you've been quoted in there as saying this and that and all, and we don't think that you have the best interest of NASA JPL. And I said, well, you know, all I did was just tell what really took place. And she said, well, we think that you should resign. Don't employees have their opinion? Oh, yeah. She says, our employees, they all have their own personal opinion. I said, they're being paid for this. Is that right? She says, well, of course. And I said, and I'm not being paid as a solar system ambassador, my time, my money, and everything else, to promote your program, but you want me to resign. I said, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. You'd have to fire me. So the next day, mind you, or 2 days later, is when Mr. Hoagland was taking me to the 2006 press conference. And so while I receive a letter in the mail from JPL that has then terminated my stature, my position with the Solar System Ambassador Organization. And then 2 days later, I'm at the National Press Club telling the world what has happened and what they did and why. And so you asked why I came forward. The reason I came forward, it was the only smart, safest thing that could be done. And I'll say that for anyone else out there, that if you think you're safe by keeping what you know quiet, it's actually the wrong thing to do. You need to come forward and you need to be public. Whether you are bashful, shy, or you know, buck-toothed or what, I don't care. If you've got the knowledge and information in your head, you need to get it out there now while you're still here.
Okay, for 2015-16, what is prompting you to step up and tell more now?
Okay, my archive has been available to scientists from around the world through Richard Hoagland and their Enterprise team, and just about anybody of any reputation that's contacted me. Kind of the way it has worked is that people will look at what's been published by the government, I'll say it that way, and they see something that looks like it's not a natural thing on the lunar surface or on Mars, either one, and through connections they'll get a hold of me and they'll say, well, what about the photograph AS 15-88111 970. And I'll go to my archive and I'll pull up my copy, which is off of the originals that I've kept all these years in safes and in plastic jackets, which has kept the oxygen from deteriorating. We'll take a look at it and say, oh my God, would you take a look? They were taking a picture of the command module going around the moon when they rendezvoused with it, and the whole thing was get a good picture of it while they're getting the rendezvous. No one thought to look down on the lunar surface down below them, and there is a whole base laid out in domes. I mean, it's so obvious. I had never seen it myself, and I've had these for 40, 45 years, and I never looked at it. And there was a graphic artist, Brett Shepard. He looked at that, and he said, would you look at what's down on the moon? And I said, oh, my God. I've never looked at that. I've just been looking at the command module, because I'm an engineer. I'm more fixed towards how did they rendezvous, how did they dock, what did they bring up, what did they do at the descent stage, et cetera, step by step of each mission, not what was on the surface. And now I take a different tack whenever someone pulls out. I'll start looking at the pictures myself. And I picked out a few things that I saw it before Brett did. But then, no, he's got a trained eye as an artist. And he's not the only one. There's one of the other ones that I'm very good friends with, and that's Mr. Steve Troy. Steve Troy probably has the best collection of photographs from both the lunar missions and the Mars missions in his collection. Again, we're getting older. If you ask how old I am, I'm dyslexic. I'm only 37. Now figure that one out. Now I'm 73. And some others that are younger than me, you know, when you're young, you don't think about this. But when you start getting older, I joke about the first thing my wife and I do on Sunday morning at the newspaper is we look in the obituary column to see if we're there. If we're not, we're good for another week. So anyway, that's pretty much why I brought this forward. Because if I died and it was not put into an archive or a book and stuff, then nobody else would have the opportunity to see what was really there. And so I'm very fortunate that I ran into you folks. And I had started trying to write my autobiography, which was leading up to how I wound up jokingly at the right place at the right time with the right stuff to do the right thing. And yeah. I took that's a little play on words from Alan Shepard's book called The Right Stuff, and he coined that phrase. I just kind of played off of it a little bit. So I'm very busy in the middle of volume one of my book is out there now, and it's called Ken's Moon. And it's basically starts from when I was born and the events that have happened all through my life. There's no way I could have planned my life to wind up places where I was and things like that. I don't know if you believe in divine intervention or ET intervention, but there are certainly some situations where I would not have survived. And I put those in the book, and leads right up to actually getting into at NASA. And then Volume 2, decided to go ahead and put the whole archive out there. So there's over 800 some odd pictures and things that information that's going to be released. And I think probably within the next couple of weeks, maybe, certainly, definitely, the first part of January. Mm-hmm. So then there's so much stuff there that I've saved that needed to be made public where everybody else can study it, and just the youth can have an opportunity that the material information is there instead of someone coming up to me or like they did Buzz Aldrin saying, you guys didn't go to the moon, you lied to it. And, you know, Buzz Aldrin lost his temper and he decked the guy. Way to go there, Buzz. You know, they do the same thing. And they'll challenge me and say, well, I don't think we really went there. And I said, well, I mean, you were still wetting diapers whenever we did, so what do you expect?
Well, your parents were wetting diapers.
Well, okay, your grandparents. All right.
Depending on the age of the person, yeah.
It is true. And if you set them down and you can show them the real stuff, then they have to sit back and one of them, I gave him so much information. He said, I'm going to have to think about this. Because his whole reason for his glory and his fame was to debunk and to attack those of us who actually did the work.
I'm generation where we watched it happen. I was a kid in school. Right. And we watched it happen.
I was the generation that made it happen.
Yeah, exactly. So we were kind of watching that happen, and because it was all on TV, we didn't know all the behind-the-scenes things that were going on. It was a TV show.
You know, one of the most fascinating things, and actually Dr. Werner von Braun was at one of the conferences I went to. It was, NASA had so many acronyms. Every time something came up, they would create an acronym for it, and I hate acronyms. If you can talk about the National Aeronautics Space Administration, say that. When NASA becomes coined so well, you can do that, or JPL, or whatever. Mm-hmm. We had a staff meeting at the Johnson Space Center where Von Braun was there, and we were looking at a schedule. We had a goal. President John F. Kennedy said, we want to send men to the moon before this decade is out and return them safely to the Earth. Well, that was our objective and our goal. We had to backtrack from there to where we were now with our tech. We were so far behind in technology, and amazing the stuff that Dr. von Braun and them had already been tinkering with back during Germany's heyday. I had the privilege of sitting in on these meetings, and I actually listened to them say, okay, now we're going to have to be able to have a vacuum chamber big enough to test this vehicle in, so we need to do that. We need to be able to get it as near a vacuum as we can, so how are we going to? And we scheduled breakthroughs in scientific advancements in order to meet that schedule. Well, do you think you guys can invent that and have that ready by this date? And one of the engineers says, I've got a good idea, I've got a good plan, we'll work on it. And that's what we were stuck with, and that's what we actually were able to do, and to meet the objective and the goal to land on the moon and get them back in time. So it's amazing. We don't see that happening anymore.
Yeah, I would like to invent free energy tomorrow. Seems like that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's excellent. If you were to tell somebody who doesn't know anything about this, the young people, you just told the kind of the history of it, how you guys made that happen. But, you know, what your feelings were, this is a big question that's come up, is what were you feeling like, or did you have time to feel anything during that time?
Interesting you should ask that way, because at Mission Control, we have a room back, we call it the MOCR, or Mission Operations Control Center room, and this is where a lot of the scientists and engineers for each one of the companies or each one of the devices, the environmental control systems or the lunar module itself or the command module, we were in the back rooms. Now, there was only room for like one or two from each one of these corporations that had a major part in producing the hardware. And in my case, since my job was pretty much finished up as one of the liaisons for the regular astronauts and substitutes for the regular astronauts, so I chose to take the vacation right after Apollo 11 launched. It was in what we call the translunar insertion, TLI. So while they were on the way going to the moon, I'm taking my family and driving from Houston, Texas to Marysville, South Boundbrook, New Jersey. So I got there and I got to watch Neil and Buzz take the first steps on the moon at my mother and father-in-law's house in New Jersey. This was tremendously exciting, and because we knew exactly what they were doing. In fact, I had been made the chief test director of the TM-5 vehicle after the vacuum chamber testing of the regular lunar module. The TM-5 was the descent stage, and the astronauts had to learn not only how to come down the steps on the landing leg, but then to go around to the payload bay and open up the hinges to make it fold up to be able to take out the scientific equipment and experiment packages called the ALSEP, that's Apollo Lunar Surface Information Equipment, and then lay it out on the lunar surface so far away from the lunar module so when they launch, they wouldn't tear it up. And there's actually scientific equipment that was used, a nuclear-type power generation plant, to get its energy, its current, or that is still producing information on the moon today.
Wow.
So how did I feel about it? It was tremendously exciting. So we drove back from New Jersey back to Houston, and I went into work. I had been assigned a new position, and that would be to help maintain and write the AOH, that's the Apollo Operations Handbooks, one for the lunar module and one for command module. And Mr. John Pierce was the director of that, and we had our office on the second floor, building 4, which was the astronauts' building at JSC. And that has its great advantages because all the astronauts and stuff are readily available to us. Anyway, I came back, went into work that morning, and I said, "Good morning, John, I'm back." He says, Sit down. He says, I don't know how to tell you this, but the government's gotten involved. And he says, we were working on a new project. The Hubble telescope ultimately was, it came as a result of this, but originally a telescope similar to Hubble was to be mounted to the bottom of an ascent stage lunar module. Because remember, we had 20 lunar modules in the assembly line at Grumman in Bethpage, Long Island. And we had Apollo 11 landed on the moon, Apollo 12, Apollo 13 had the accident and went around the moon and came back, Apollo 14, 15, 16, and 17 that actually landed on the moon. So we still had 18, 19, and 20 lunar modules in the assembly line that we were working on, and we would have used one of those to put the telescope mounted to it, and it would then separate from Skylab space station back away, and they could use it to look at the stars like we're using Hubble today. He said the government's involved, and they've canceled the Lunar Module Telescope project. And he says, and consequently, your job has gone away. Grumman was really nice to me. They gave me a bonus. They gave me 2 weeks severance pay, and they gave me 2 weeks to find another job at full salary. So I basically had more than a month to find a job. A week and a half later, I went to work at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, and I caught Neil and Buzz and Mike. Well, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins, I know my first names, at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory in quarantine. The excitement got dulled down a little bit because I had to find another job real quick. Unfortunately, and I think it really, looking back, it was part of in the plan to move so fast to get from one phase to the next that, like what had happened to me, the contract was over, it got laid off, that once we had finished landing Apollo 11 on the moon, we're no longer doing R&D, research and development, by sending missions to the moon. These are going to be routine flights to the moon, scientific investigations. Grumman laid off almost 30,000 employees nationwide. I can only guess when you take that with the Lockheed Martin and those that had to lay off and theirs equally and all the other subcontractors. We had PhD scientists on the streets in downtown Houston selling newspapers. Now, you can say the scientists that had done their part, we accomplished Kennedy's goal. We went to the moon, we landed, we came back. We discovered stuff we didn't know and things we needed to find out. We had to find a way of supporting our families. And as a result, I think the best minds that were part of the mission were there, moved out into the public domain, finding positions and jobs and things like that, and drifted away from the excitement that we had of actually going to the moon. And since they didn't slap on to keep going and maybe going to Mars, we should have been on Mars, mind you, by 1979, 10 years after we landed on the moon. We had the technology. We knew how to do it. When President Bush announced that we were going to go to Mars during his term, NASA didn't know what to do. They sent technicians to go out to museums and to measure and mic and photograph equipment and the materials and things that we had invented for the lunar missions, because they had lost them. The same thing at the time when they laid us off. They were actually government, I don't know what you call them, men in black or whatever. They came to our homes and said, do you have any of the AOHs or these documents or the drawings and things like that? And they confiscated as much as they could get. And fortunately, I didn't give up my archive. Okay. So I guess the excitement was there, but it was all dulled down. And then I went, when I was a guest of the BBC, the British Broadcasting Network, they flew me from Albuquerque to Houston for an interview and a show and tell around NASA. NASA had a public relations person meet us at the entrance, and he came up and we introduced ourselves, and he says, you're Ken Johnston? You're an icon. And I quipped, you mean like on a cursor on a computer, an icon, you know? He says, no, he says, we don't know how to do what you guys did. And to me, that was a confession of fact. So we've lost the momentum, and I'm not sure how we're going to gain that back.
Okay, Ken, for this question, I would like to have you talk about your Volume 1, Ken's Moon, My Human Experience, where you talk about your early history and how you miraculously became who you are today. When I was going through reading it, it reminded me of my two sons and all the scraps they got into, and I was saying to myself, if they got through with their eyes intact and their fingers and toes intact, I would have been done a good job. But it was really enjoyable to work with you on the project. And could you please go into that history a little bit?
Well, okay. Volume 1 really is an autobiography, and then most of you know that's going to start off with, like, well, how did you get here to begin with? And of course, you had to have a mom and a dad. So whenever I go out and I give talks, people want to know, you know, just how did you wind up from being born to where you are now, and what happened in between. So I chose to do that with Volume 1 and start off with just basically the genealogy. There all kinds of interesting things happened during my lifetime, which I think is only about one-third over, right, at 73. Anyway, I was born in a little army base during World War II in 1942 at Fort Sam Houston, San Antonio, Texas. So I'm a native-born Texan. I grew up there, wound up, my dad was killed in World War II as a pilot. And the only pictures I had of him were pictures of him in uniform, Captain Abraham Russell Johnston. And I always wanted to become a pilot and grow up and be like my dad. So that was kind of my motivation to start with. And then after that, my mother did marry a captain in the Marine Corps, Roger Walmeldorf, that had come back from fighting in the Pacific in the islands in Guadalcanal, came back with a terrible fungus growing in his ears that they couldn't stop, and ultimately it leached its way through the ear into his brain cavity, and the pain was so great he just went out and curled up in the car with the carbon monoxide gas and got rid of all the pain for the rest of it. But it's when you realize what the man had gone through before that, you have to understand that he gave it all. Anyway, so I wound up growing up on a farm in a little town called Hart, Texas, where Mom married a staff sergeant from Korea, T.C. Ray. My older brother decided to go and live with the grandparents up in Oklahoma, and that left Jimmy, my middle brother. He was 17 months older than me, at the little country town of 560 people called Hart, Texas. And Jimmy loved the farming, and he loved that life, and I didn't. I was focused on, I wanted to find some way to get to wear a fancy uniform. And so when Hart got his very first van, and we got all these used uniforms from this school, my brother and I would get out on the street. We'd have on our uniforms and we'd march up and down the street. Dirt roads, mind you. And the street consisted of maybe about four houses. Anyway, so my brother, Jimmy, every year around Halloween, they would have a hayride. For those who don't know what a hayride is, it's you usually have a tractor pulling a wagon with a bunch of hay bales, and the kids are on there with soda pop, foods, and fun, and they go out and get this driven around out in the country. And it's just a way of bringing in the winter harvest. And unfortunately, some illegal aliens were out drinking, drunk, and they whipped around the corner, hit the tractor, and flipped it over to my brother, and my brother lost his life there. So all of a sudden, I went from being the baby of the family to the only one left, because AR had living with grandparents, and Jimmy, he always protected me from the bullies. If anybody picked on me, he'd clean their clock.
And Richard Hoagland was very excited about your collection. I'd like to have you describe some of the things that we're seeing.
There are so many that have come out in the past 20 years that I think probably the most exciting one really ties back to while I was at the Data and Photo Control Department at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. And after Apollo 14 came back, we had the chief scientist that was in charge of the astronomers. It was Dr. Thornton Page. Dr. Thornton Page was a very distinguished-looking gentleman, always wore a three-piece suit, and a very distinguished-looking patch, like a pirate, over one eye. I never discussed with him how he lost his eye. It was none of my business. But a brilliant man. He came to me at the Data and Photo Control Department, my office, and said, Ken, would you go to the main photo lab and pull out the 16-millimeter film strip for thus and such number that was taken during the Apollo 14 mission? Now, what most people don't realize, and I think it's kind of sad, because there were three people that went to the moon every time we went there. Two of them landed on the moon and did the experiments and walked around on the surface. The third person, if he hadn't been there, they wouldn't have come home. Now, such as Apollo 11, you had Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins. Mike Collins stayed in orbit around the lunar module in the command module. One of the, he was busy all the time doing experiments and astronomy and stuff, and then photographing the lunar surface. We were still mapping the surface of the moon at that time. So Dr. Page, now he knew that I was a prior military flight training and also knew how to operate 16-millimeter projectors, and specifically one which is called a gun sequence camera projector. And I'll describe that for the people who are listening that may not be familiar. You may have seen old newsreels of air battles in World War II or what have you, and one airplane's chasing another, and you can see the bullets and tracers going up. That's a camera that was mounted that was taking pictures of the cannons or the guns or what have you when they would fire them. And it's called a gun sequence because it would fire, it would take a picture in between each fire. So that's why it produced more of a video. Well, Dr. Page asked me to check this one out and take it over to the building next to the mission control, a one-story building right next door to the mission control building, and set up a showing for him and seven of the other scientists in his group for the next day. I went over to the photo lab and checked out the real film and went over to the building, and we had a screen set up inside this little conference room. They had provided me with a gun sequence camera projector. Now, the projector is different than your standard movie projector because it could allow me to freeze a frame, to back up frames, to zoom in close, and or take them in a sequence of 3, 5, or 10 frames at a time, click, 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 jumping forward. This particular reel, we were where they were mapping and filming the backside of the moon. When I was in like the fourth grade and a teacher was telling me that the backside of the moon was always dark, and I said, no, it's not dark. And here I am only in like the third or fourth grade. And she was right, and I said, well, here, let's do this. So I took a basketball, and I had her stand there and had someone shine a flashlight on, and I moved around with the ball and could see it. You know, the phases you see of the moon and the shadows, and all, that's all part of where the sun is shining on. And so whenever it's dark on the front side from the Earth looking at the moon, the sun is shining on the back side. Here we are. I'm looking at the film, and I'm showing it for them, and they're sitting in the back. We're coming up on a big crater called a medium-sized crater, about 120 miles across. It's big for me, Tsiolkovsky. And the sun angle was about 45 degrees, so about half of the crater was in shadow. And as the command module was flying over the crater slightly off to the side, in the shadowed portion of that crater, there was five little lights, looked like domes, five domes illuminated from the inside, and one of them looked like a straight stream of gas had been ejected out from the top of one of them. And he had me freeze, he had me stop, back up, come in again, zoom in on this. The way I describe it, if you'll take your hand, turn it palm side up, bring all five of your fingers together, and look at them on top, they look like five little round balls. And that's what we were looking at on the back side of the moon. Dr. Page turned to the other guys and says, well, boys, what do you think of that? And they all laughed like it was an inside joke. And he says, okay, finish up. So I showed the rest of that film strip, and they talked for a while I packed up everything and had to check it back into the photo lab. And because I was scheduled to show that same reel the next day at the main auditorium for the rank and file engineers and technicians and janitors and secretaries and everybody to come see what the backside of the moon looked like. That's kind of the way they phrased it. And I had my brother and a few of them sitting there with me in the projection booth. I said, you guys won't believe what we found on the backside of the moon. I'm really excited about it. Here we are. We're going along. I'm showing it. We're approaching Tsiolkovsky, and there's the shadowed part, and there's nothing there. When I checked the film in the day before, the photo lab, you go in the outside where it's people who come up to a desk and they order a picture or what have you, and that's as far as they go. You had to have a secret clearance to go into the inner chamber,
Then you had to have a top secret clearance to get into the back storage area. Of course, I had top secret clearances. So I go in, and I'm in the inner sanctum area. There are three people sitting at a big light table that's about 4 by 6, whatever. The negatives they were looking at, they were, with paintbrushes, they were painting things out on the negatives. And I'm checking in this film, and I'm like, well, what are you guys doing? One of the guys quipped real quick. He says, oh, we're professional strippers. There's a young lady there with them, and she said, no. She says, what we're doing, we are stripping out the stars and things on the horizon that would be confusing. People want to see what the moon looked like. They don't want to see things that would be confusing. And so I checked in the film, and then when I checked out the next day, that was just explaining about when I'm showing it, and there was nothing there. I froze the camera. I told the audience, I said, I'm having technical difficulties. Bear with me, sir. I took that film strip out, and I ran through it and looked, and there was no evidence that it had been cut or spliced. So within 24 hours, they had to have made a copy, spliced it back in, and then made a duplicate of that, put it into the main place. After that, when I checked it back in, then I ran into Dr. Page that afternoon over at the Lunar Seed Laboratory outside. And I said, Dr. Page, what happened to that stuff that was on the backside of the moon that we saw? And he looked at me. Now, mind you, I said he has one eye covered with a patch. But when he looks at you and he closes the other and kind of squinches up, he smiles and says, there was never anything there. That probably was one of the most exciting things that I could. Since then, I'm amazed at the other things that geologists have looked at that they didn't know they were looking at things on the moon or on Mars. And they say, well, yeah, that's strange. And once, as soon as they find out what it is, that it's from the moon or it's from Mars, they get, I'm not part of this. Most scientists get their money from government grants. And if you bite the hand that's feeding you. So we need people that have maybe had their careers finished and they don't need to worry about government dole of money coming their way. They will come out and tell the truth. Get out there. I did it. I'm still here. You can do it too.
To get the book, Ken's Moon, The Smoking Gun That Reveals a Dark Mission of NASA, Volume 1, My Human Experience, an autobiography by Dr. Ken Johnston Sr., go to www.kenjohnstonmedia.com. You'll find a link there to purchase his ebook, as well as announcements of upcoming volumes.
Please listen carefully.
I'd like to thank all the listeners today, and also to Dr. Ken Johnston for this wonderful interview, and the wonderful musicians on freemusicarchive.org, to Jazzar for the song Please Listen Carefully, to Chris Zabriskie for the song I Can't Imagine Where I'd Be Without It. And of course for Aquarian Radio and Janet Lesson at aquarianradio.com. This track has the information on where to find Ken's book.
Earning an executive MBA at Georgetown isn't the path of least resistance, but it does come with the greatest reward. Benefit from our strong alumni network, renowned faculty, DC location, and global residencies. Get started at choosegeorgetown.com/EMBA.